Kurt Smith joins us again on Sports Byline USA, the noted baseball broadcast historian. And every time he has a new book out, we invite him to join us. And he has a new one out. It's an excellent read. It's called Mercy, a celebration of Fenway Park Centennial, told through Red Sox radio and TV. Kurt, now I know you're a big Red Sox fan, so it was a natural thing for you to gravitate to. But usually when somebody gravitates to something that they know and they have a passion about it, there's a special challenge involved in doing a book about that passion. Tell me a little bit about the passions for this one.
Well, the passion literally is deep held and long held is derived quite literally from my mother, to whom the book is dedicated. My mom was born in Worcester, 40 miles from Boston, and she was a Red Sox fan. In fact, she and my dad took their honeymoon in New England, and one of the highlights was a trip to Fenway Park, where they saw a certain hitter, number 9, Theodore Samuel Williams, Ted Williams, the greatest hitter who ever lived. So, Ron, I have been a Red Sox fan since I can remember, and so writing a book about Fenway Park in its centennial was a natural evolution for me. And the only trick was, since there is a blizzard of books about Fenway Park turning 100 years young this year, was how to separate my book from countless others. And the natural answer, since I have written, as you suggest, about broadcasting in the past, was to do it through the prism of Red Sox or radio and TV, through the voices of the game. So this is really three books in one. A story about Fenway Park, a story about the Red Sox, the charter franchise, 1901 in the American League, and then, of course, about their voices on the wireless and TV as well.
Let's go back and start with the franchise itself. Give us a little thumbnail history on the Red Sox.
Well, 1901, and they have been with us for better and for often worse ever since. And they were actually, and amazingly, considering their reputation, baseball's first dynasty. They won 5 of baseball's first 15 World Series. The last was in 1918, and it would have stretched credulity to suggest that the Sox then would have gone the next 86 years without a world title. But, of course, as we know, credulity led to infamy, because that's precisely what they did. And they became really the successor, if you would, to the 1950s Brooklyn Dodgers, and that is snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. And in doing so, and in doing so in such a surrealistic way, Ron, they became the hero of every dog that was under, and they became the sentimental favorite of everyone who loves someone who is not supposed to win and doesn't. And so that enormously expanded their appeal. So that was one story. And then, of course, the story of Fenway Park, which opened in 1912. And this goes under the rubric of appeal of coming attractions, and that is the Boston Red Sox Fenway Park opened, you can look it up, the very week in 1912 that the Titanic sank.
Certain franchises have special lore associated with it, and I think that's safe to say that the Red Sox certainly have a lot of lore associated with it. Most notably was the Curse of the Bambino. Tell me about that and also other lore associated with the Red Sox.
Well, the curse was the preeminent lore, if you would, for so many years. As I say, the Sox won 5 of the first 15 World Series, the last in 1918. Then with a marvelous, if you would, gift for timing, the Sox proceed to sell Babe Ruth to the Yankees. The Yankees win their first of 27 World Series. The Red Sox, as I say, go 86 years without a World Series. And this becomes then the curse of the Bambino, that they sell Babe Ruth, and then boom, they go almost 90 years strolling like Moses the wasteland, becoming the wretched of the earth. And in a sense, as I said as well, though, the silver lining for this is that without this, the Sox would not have become nearly as beloved as they did. You can look it up as well when you look at this. Between 1946 and 2003, count them, 13 times, the Red Sox lost a division, pennant, or World Series on the last or next-to-last day of the season. There is no team in any major sport in the United States who comes close to, let alone match, the Red Sox' spectacular propensity for ineptitude. And not just ineptitude, but amazing, ill-timed ineptitude, where almost like a Charlie Brown having the football snatched from them. And so add this to the appeal of Fenway Park, asymmetrical, idiosyncratic, very intimate, up close and personal, where the ballpark becomes less a spectator than a participant. And Theodore Samuel Williams, as I mentioned, Ted Williams, the greatest hitter who ever lived, who had almost as many nicknames, Teddy Ballgame and the Splendid Splinter and the Kid, as he did batting title six. And what you had was a franchise evolving into one of the most beloved in the entire country.
Also, I think every franchise certainly has players that are iconic to that franchise. But in the case of the Boston Red Sox, I think they have a plethora of those iconic players. You mentioned about Ted Williams. You talk about Carl Yastrzemski, Bobby Doerr. I mean, I could go right down the list. Am I correct?
Bobby Doerr, the silent captain of the Red Sox. In fact, a very close friend of Ted Williams. He was the Sox second baseman. And he was very taciturn and quite introverted. Ted, of course, was the exact antithesis. Perhaps because of this, they became very close friends. And they loved to fish. This was one of their many ties. And Bobby Doerr ultimately would go fishing with Williams and in the end insisted upon what he called the 90-10 rule. And that was that Bobby Doerr insisted that he get to talk at least 10% of the time whenever he and Williams were together. But you had Doerr, you had Johnny Pesky at shortstop, Dom DiMaggio, the little professor in center field, you had Rudy York, you had Tex Houston and Ellis Kinder, and Mel Parnell on the mound, you had Joe McCarthy, their great manager. You had one Hall of Famer after the other. The Red Sox have, I think, by last checking, 16 or 17 members of the Sox who played regularly now in the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. You mentioned Carl Yastrzemski, Jim Rice, Carlton Fisk. I would add to that Carlton Fisk, who hit undoubtedly, along with Ted Williams' home run in 1960 in his final time at bat, Fisk's home run in 1975, add to that, which, of course, won Game 6 and prolonged that spectacular World Series with Cincinnati, those the two most memorable World Series, or rather home runs in Sox history. So really, it has been a franchise, I think, second only to the Yankees in terms of household names in the American League and very possibly in all of baseball.
The adding to the mystique is certainly the ballpark itself, because anybody who has ever been there or seen picture of Fenway Park knows that it is so unique. It's in the heart of the city. Tell me a little bit about how it was placed there and the original design, which still holds today.
Well, the ballpark, as I said, was built in 1912, and it was named Fenway Park because the original owner of the Red Sox, John Taylor, said, well, it's in the Fenway section of Boston, isn't it? Then call it Fenway Park. And indeed they did. And it was asymmetrical, as I mentioned, and idiosyncratic because it was placed within and inside of a grid of urban city blocks. For example, people ask why the left field foul pole was only 310 feet from home plate. For many years, it was thought to be 315. Then it was measured and remeasured and found to be only 310. The reason is because behind left field was a Lansdowne Street. And Lansdowne Street could not be moved and could not be bought. And the Red Sox owner, Tom Yawkey, tried to do both for many years and many times. And so it remained only 310 feet. And 420 feet to the triangle in center field. 379 feet to left center field, only 302 feet down the right field line to Pesky's pole, named by Joe Castiglione, the Red Sox radio announcer, because Johnny Pesky hit all Ron of 17 career home runs, and he hit eight of them off the pole at right field at Fenway Park, and therefore had a pole named in his honor. Or, in fact, Williamsburg in right center field at Fenway Park, where a bullpen was inserted to decrease the footage to right center field to the bleachers, and the bullpen was named Williamsburg because it helped Ted Williams, because the footage was decreased by almost, as I said, 20 feet. So unlike the cookie cutters of the 1960s and 70s and 80s, this is a ballpark with soul. This is a ballpark where generations memorized, in fact, the distances, which could and did vary, and also the heights of the different walls. For example, 3 feet down the right field of line, or if you go to the monster named in left field, 37 feet and 2 inches from the ground to the top of the wall. For many years, top of the green monster was a screen into which home runs were hit. Then, in the early part of the 21st century, the Red Sox ditched the screen for what were called green monster seats. And many purists like me said, what are you doing? You don't tamper with success. Well, the Red Sox did, and they made a successful park even better, because today green monster seats are the most pricey and most ritzy seats in all of New England.
Hold on a minute, Kurt.
If a park has personality, Fenway Park is it.
Kurt Smith is with us. The name of his book, Mercy, A Celebration of Fenway Park. We'll tell you more about this as we continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on America's Sports Talk Show.